Well, happy birthday to 14-year-old Kyle somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. Avid listener, huddled up in bed, listening with his portable radio. Hey, Kyle, many, many more birthdays to you, my friend. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Linda Moulton Howe, our special reporter tonight. Linda, let's pick up your investigation.
Yes, and thanks for mentioning the upcoming conference, because John Burroughs will be joining me in my presentation at Ryan Wood's UFO Crash Conference in Las Vegas, November 6th to 8th at the Tuscany Suites Hotel and Casino. John and I will be speaking on Saturday, November 7th, midday. And to register for this conference, go to earthfiles.com, and there is a hot link right at the top of the headlines page. And I hope a lot of Coast listeners can make it and come and introduce yourself to us. We will have a lot more to report by November 7th. Now, John was born in Bloomington, Illinois. So Jim Peniston was also born in Illinois, or Michigan, and lived in Illinois. So they're both Midwestern guys. John was born in Bloomington in 1960 and joined the U.S. Air Force right after high school graduation. He received orders to go to RAF Bentwaters, England, and arrived in July 1979, about 18 months before the highly strange encounters with lights, beams, and craft in the Rendlesham Forest. During that time, John worked as an Air Force police officer and says, nothing strange ever happened until after midnight on December 26, just like Richard Bertolino said. And that's when John Burroughs joined Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston and fellow Airman Ed Kabanczak to investigate blue, red, orange, and white lights glowing in the forest. Jim Peniston remembers approaching the lights, seeing a solid, black, glassy, triangle-shaped craft on the forest floor resting on tripod legs. He photographed, measured, and drew sketches in his notebook. But John Burroughs, who was right there with Peniston, does not remember any of that. Later, Jim Peniston realized that his notebook's timeline had 45 minutes of missing time. Further, Airman Richard Bertolino on Bunker Hill was listening to Sergeant Peniston's radio transmissions until security control called for radio silence about an hour after Sergeant Peniston and the other men went into the forest. John Burroughs recently talked with Lieutenant Fred Baran, who said radio silence was requested because security control lost all radio contact with Sergeant Peniston for about 45 minutes. So it sounds like there is definitely 45 minutes of missing time here. Right from the beginning, the men saw what they could not explain, and something happened to the minds of those eyewitnesses, either in the forest, in later military interrogations, or both. The results have been blank or confused memories. Even two men, Sergeant James Peniston and Airman John Burroughs, who were right next to each other in Rendlesham Forest between RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge, do not remember the same details. Here now is John Burroughs struggling to penetrate his lost memory.
The hardest part for me is that I remember certain things. I know what I remember. I know what my statement says. I know that what I drew was what we came close to. That part I definitely remember. The stories over the years with them coming out and saying I jumped on something, I was drawn into something, could have been the night with Peniston, and it could have been the third night when I was out there with Colonel Hall. How much missing time? I do believe there was some kind of distortion in time, and it was very interesting under hypnosis to confirm something did happen to me, and I had some kind of interaction with whatever was out there.
And we're still trying to get further breakthrough to see if you can remember more details.
Yes. The hardest problem I have is I spent 26 years in the Air Force, and what happened over those three nights, we did not follow proper procedures and protocol. Things that went on do not add up. Things that went on afterwards don't add up. We were in the largest tech fighter wing in the Air Force. We were at a frontline NATO base that if war broke out, our aircraft would proceed over to Germany and bring other aircraft in for another mission. We had some officers that all went on to very distinguished careers in Space Command, and all of them are sitting there trying to tell us that, well, we really didn't have anything to do with it. Something did happen. you were good men doing your job, but we can't really comment on it.
Jim Penniston made the comment that it appeared that the base commander then, Colonel Conrad, must have had a lot more information than he ever shared with you and Jim Penniston when both of you were asked to see first Lieutenant Moran, the shift commander. That went in a kind of perfunctory way. And then a couple of days later, or maybe by December 29th, you were asked to go and talk to Colonel Charles Hault. And he asked both of you a lot of questions, but then you walked across the hall to the base commander's office. Colonel Conrad, he asked you and Jim to sit down and tell him what you had seen, and he never asked you a single question.
Right. Something did happen off base. We were out there for three different nights. Something did happen around the weapons storage area. I do know the radio traffic was recorded through the command post that night, and I believe to this day that Captain Verano came forward and said a tape was sent over to Germany, and I believe that was the actual tape of the radio traffic that night. And if that tape was ever to be released, I still believe it's out there. That would blow this case completely wide open.
The very fact that what was happening in the towers and being recorded has never been released, that's a cover-up.
Right, because the tape didn't get destroyed. What took place off base and what took place in the area of the weapons storage area, that tape was listened to. And I've also been told that the NSA has files on the incident and they have different documents there. So my best bet is the tape is sitting at the National Security Agency. And the fact that it would confirm a lot of what's been said, and it would clearly show that there was some kind of strange phenomena going on over the base. Colonel Hall's tape shows that something very strange happened.
Those audio tapes that would have been done by people who were in control towers would be extremely valuable as the running timeline of events as they happened those three nights. Further, it might explain why Colonel Hault told Peter Robbins when he was working on the book Left at Eastgate in the mid-90s that he knew for a fact that a beam had come down into the RAF Bentwaters weapons storage area and had gone through soil, metal, and cement and interacted with nuclear warheads.
I do know that a C-5 came in Sunday night. It involves the weapons storage area. It was parked and had its own security.
And John, you're talking then about the 29th, the 30th, the 31st of December after the three nights of events.
Yes, the plane came in on Sunday night. I do know that on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I was posted on the East Gate. I do know there was activity in the woods all 3 days. I did see a chopper lift something out of the woods and bring it over to the Woodbridge flight line over by the 67th ARS, which was pararescue on Tuesday night. So I do know there was stuff going on afterwards. I know there was people in the woods. I was posted on the gate, and I was told because I was involved in the incident, I saw strange things, that's why they put me there. And then if I saw anything strange happening in the woods, not to call it on the radio, they were well aware that there was activity going on in the woods.
And they meant don't go through radio traffic, call us on a phone line?
Yes.
They wanted to keep a low profile if anything more happened in the woods.
Right, or anything that I saw going on.
Control of the phenomena was already starting to kick in. Whether you knew what was happening at higher levels of authority or not, you were already being told, do not call on the radio, call on the phone.
Yes, that's what I was told. To me, we weren't taken care of. I mean, we were out doing our job. General Williams, he has said that. We were good men doing our jobs. We were not taken care of. We should have all been checked out because we had something strange happen to us. So medically, we should have been brought in and checked out. We should have been debriefed on everything that happened to us. People have said they've been interrogated, which I don't understand why guys doing their job would be interrogated. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
The fact that Staff Sergeant James Penniston was asked to do sodium pentothal hypnosis and that it lasted for 3.5 hours.
And that's totally wrong.
Can you describe how you got back into Rendlesham Forest and what was your interaction with Colonel Hault?
You saw something like light, really bright and white, and it came down and started hovering out in the distance in the forest. He asked me, was that what we saw the first night? I told him I wasn't sure, And I asked him if I could move forward to get a better view of it. And he cleared me to go forward with Bastinza. Bastinza had a radio on him, and I went towards the object.
And this is Sergeant Adrian Bastinza. You have been given verbal clearance by the deputy base commander, Colonel Halt, for you to go forward toward the now reddish-orange light in the sky with Adrian Bastinza. What happens?
We're in contact with the WSA tower. Adrian and I were running towards the object. Adrian went down to the ground, and I got closer to it. And the next thing I know, I don't know how long it was afterwards, I'm standing in the field right when I got close to whatever it was, and it's gone. And I'm just standing in the field with Adrian behind me.
And what do you say to each other?
Well, I come back towards him, and he told me that whatever it was came over the top of me.
Did he see you rise up into this object?
He didn't tell me when we were out in the field, but when I talked to him on the phone a few years later, he said, yes, it appeared to be that I was pulled up into the sky. And he also told me that he didn't fall down. He was knocked down, and something held him to the ground.
And this would explain all of the rumors about you either jumping on the craft or being taken up in a beam of light into the craft.
Yes, it would. I've always felt that when those rumors came out, it wasn't the first night with Jim and I. I went in hypnosis to try to figure out what happened.
Something as dramatic as Adrian Bastinza being able to tell you later that he saw the reddish-orange light come over you, and that you appeared to go up into it. Charles Halt and everybody else must have known what happened to you and Bastinza in the forest.
He was behind us, so I'm not sure exactly what he saw.
And you have a memory loss, a missing time on that early morning hours event with Adrian Bastinza on December 28th, 1980.
Yeah, there's definitely something. I mean, when I got close to whatever it was, I have no idea what happened. Also, I have spoken to the guy that was in the tower that night, and he did confirm what I'm saying is true. He remembers talking to me on the radio. He remembers me getting close to the object. He also remembers clearly that he said he could see the object hovering over the woods. And he said the object was there for quite a while.
And Adrian Bastinza, as far as he's concerned, went prone to the ground in a defensive move.
He said he fell to the ground, but he claims that he was pushed down. Something forced him to the ground, held him to the ground. He never went down to the ground on his own. Something forced him to the ground.
Adrian Bastinza saw you rise up into this reddish-orange light, not the blue light. Why do you think that Staff Sergeant Peniston, in early February of 1981, a full month after the events in Rendlesham, that OSI asks Staff Sergeant James Peniston to come in for the sodium pentothal hypnosis? Why do you think they focused on Staff Sergeant James Peniston and not you, the person that Adrian Bastinza says was taken up into this light?
Colonel Hall, he clearly told me that he knows I was brought in. He knows I was interrogated. He knows who did it, what was involved, and everything else. I don't remember it. So I'm not trying to say I wasn't. Just what I honestly remember was I never was brought in.
And if the point of the sodium pentothal hypnosis sessions was to block or erase the memories of men who actually encountered something of extraterrestrial origin or time travelers or from other dimensions, it might explain why for 30 years you have been haunted by not being able to sleep easily and having dreams/nightmares, and that your mind is trying to remember in spite of the efforts of the United States and the British governments to block your memory.
It's very welcome, because, I mean, the thing that sticks with me is that under hypnosis, most everything I've said comes out. There's just more to it. I can't describe what Jim and I encountered as good as Jim can. So there's a ton of discrepancies on what we saw and what went on. And as Lord Hill Norton said, it had to be a defense significance. He could not understand how all this could happen and that men were out doing their jobs and that so little would be commented on by either government and the way it was handled by either government.
And why is it that the then Prime Minister of England, Margaret Thatcher, would tell Georgina Bruni, a journalist working on a book. Yes, it happened, but we can't tell the people. And that was the title she used for her book. What is it that Margaret Thatcher and the various need-to-know agencies in the United Kingdom and the United States know about what happened in the Rendlesham Forest, December 26th to 28th, 1980, that the rest of the world cannot know?
That's a good question, and OSI and NSA needs to explain what their involvement was.
Gosh, I'm amazed, Linda, how forthright they are when they're talking to you.
Well, they're very frustrated. And you can sense their frustration, and I think anybody listening, putting themselves in the shoes of these men who encountered extraordinary phenomena over, in John's case, two nights of those three nights back in 1980, and that they all feel that they were sort of mishandled, that higher authorities knew a lot about what was happening, but they were never told. And in fact, when I interviewed Charles Holt, and he was on Coast in August, he himself was frustrated that he felt like he was left out of the information loop from General Gordon Williams and General Baisley over in Germany. Remember him talking about how he, Colonel Holt, handed over his own audio tape that he was holding in that tape recorder in his hands as they were moving through the forest, and a lot of people have heard excerpts from that in TV documentaries. Well, he gave that whole tape to General Gordon Williams, who was the top authority at RAF Bentwaters in Woodbridge, who then flew to Germany with it and took it to General Baisley in Germany. And they both and came back to Colonel Holt and said, General Baisley and I have concurred. It is a Brit E-R-I-T. It is a Brit affair. It is no concern of ours. And this was their metaphor for saying, we're not commenting. We're not doing anything with this. This was off of the base perimeter. So they were saying it's on the shoulders of the English. Well, that was right from the get-go, a kind of dismissal of the seriousness of all of this, that the men who are out there knew that the weapons storage area was even involved with some of those beams of light, and yet here the people who were the generals were saying it was simply a Brit affair. And right now, former U.S. Air Force First Class Airman John Burroughs is now organizing, or trying to, a reunion in England. He would like to get all of the guys who were there over those three nights and nights coming later, maybe in England together in 2010, maybe in the fall, close to December of 2010. And he would like to hear from everyone out there who was involved. And he has created a website and email account to organize a Bentwaters reunion.
Good.
And his website with email address in it is back to Bentwaters, all one word, back to bentwaters.blogspot.com. And this hot link is in all of my reports on Bentwaters. And I think that what is beginning to happen, I'm finding as I make appeals, and I'll make one right now for anyone listening, like Richard Bertolino and Steve LaPlume, who's coming in the next half hour with an amazing event that took place 12 days after the three nights we've just heard about and was never publicized. No one knew. You're going to hear an amazing phenomena that happened, and some of the base authorities went there too. I would love to hear at my email address at earthfiles@earthfiles.com from any of you who were in the RAF Bentwaters, we'll call it the dates of phenomena, starting at the end of December and going through January or however long it occurred, and email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Confidences are kept.
We'll be back with more with Linda Moulton Howe. Well, for just 15 cents a day, you can be a Streamlink member and get podcasts and go back to the archives now, the past 2 years. soon to be 3 years. It's just a remarkable way to have Coast to Coast at your footsteps, just right there all the time. And also, I just wanted to tell you about the brand new Coast to Coast AM app for you, iPhone and iPod Touch. People are just in awe over this. You can get full details by going to coasttocoastam.com. Now let's go back to Linda Moulton Howe, who continues with another, I think, Edward R. Murrow Award for this one. Go ahead, Linda.
Thank you, George, and God bless all of the children. After the three nights of all of those lights, beams, and the craft phenomena of 26 to 28 of December 1980, Airman John Burroughs was posted at the East Gate on Sunday night, which was the 29th of December. What he did not know was that same night, on the other side of the world, outside of Houston, Texas, a grandmother, Vicki Landrum, with her 7-year-old grandson, Colby, and her friend, Betty Cash, were driving home around 9 p.m. when they encountered a huge, brightly glowing, diamond-shaped aircraft hanging low over the road where they stopped to watch. The two women suffered exposure to radiation, and the incident became known as the Cash-Landrum encounter with a UFO. Was there any connection between what happened in England the night before on the 28th and then in Texas on the 29th? Even a few days after that, back in England at the Eastgate, another peculiar aerial phenomenon was seen that closely matched a 1979 sighting. We'd be going back into the summer before December 1980, and this was at the Scarborough Pier in North Yorkshire in England. A young woman reported seeing lights that moved in regular up and down motions like a sine wave pattern. She also saw the sine wave moving lights drop smaller lights into the sky. Well, 12 days after Deputy Base Commander Charles Holt was in the woods with John Burroughs and others and chasing after that strange aerial phenomena, more continued. So now we're going to go back to the night of January 9th, 1981, 12 days after the first series of events. Airman First Class Steve LaPlume and Senior Airman Wendell Palmer watched a bright light moving rapidly up and down in the sky in a sine wave motion. LaPlume and Palmer did report that sine wave light, and they were surprised when the RAF Woodbridge Base commander, Ted Conrad, arrived with his wife and son to see this UFO, along with the 81st Tactical Fighter Wing commander, General Gordon Edmund Williams, and Colonel Charles Holt. Whatever had been making the sine wave motion in the sky wasn't there when this group of the higher command got into the forest, and they soon left. But later that same night at the East Gate, LaPlume and Palmer watched a huge cigar-shaped craft hover close above them. Steve LaPlume first contacted me in 2005 about these other sightings that he and Palmer did not report. They didn't want notoriety that had come down on the heads of other RAF Bentwaters military personnel that were involved in December 26 to 28. They already knew that those guys were suffering from having been out in Rendlesham Forest. Steve LaPlume first contacted me about those January 9th events 4 years ago, and again after my Coast broadcast last month in August. And here now, with many more details, is former RAF Bentwaters Airman Steve LaPlume about more aerial strangeness at the Woodbridge East Gate on January 9th, 1981.
Okay.
The first time we actually saw something in the sky was Senior Airman Wendell Palmer and myself, and we were checking the back gate. Wendell first brought up the fact that the woods at the end of the road is where they saw the UFO in the southern sky. I saw, you know, kind of like when you see a satellite going across the sky at night. But this one here moved along, but it gyrated quite a bit up and down in the sky where it was moving maybe 15 degrees north and south. Then we looked at it. He left me there. He went down and checked with the control tower, and they said all they had up were a couple of C-130s and I think a helicopter with pararescue. And then we kind of lost it over some clouds over the Rendlesham Forest. So Palmer said, hey, we have to call it in. And immediately the phone rang over the booth, you know, the security booth at the East Gate. I answered it. And from then on, kind of like all hell broke loose. Officers started showing up. Gordon Williams showed up. So they all jumped in a U.S. Air Force blue van with a yellow writing on the side. It said U.S. Air Force. They went out towards the forest.
Your superior officers who arrived concluded that perhaps what had been there December 26th to the 28th had returned maybe to Rendlesham Forest.
Correct.
What did you learn happened?
Well, they went out, they came back, and they said they didn't see anything. And then I was put on that post for the rest of the night. They just wanted to keep the gate open in case something else, you know, was seen. So I was basically there to observe the sky, I guess. I stayed there. They left. They said, if we see anything, you know, let them know. And Palmer took off because he had to make some rounds and go check on his guys. And then he came back, and that's when we actually had a sighting.
Okay, what happened?
I remember seeing some lights coming in, and I thought, that's either like an A-10 or a C-130 coming in for a landing because it's coming over the trees. It's about the right elevation. Then the thing started getting closer and closer, and I remember thinking, man, that thing's going way slow. Something's wrong here. And this craft, at the time, estimate was maybe about 1,000 feet off the ground, and this thing was a couple hundred feet long. It just seemed like a huge cigar shape. And when it got over us, I remember seeing some lights underneath. I remember seeing it was a structure, and there was like a square hatch-looking thing. And I was pretty sure I was looking at the UFO. And then the craft started moving towards the right, went up in elevation, went up in clouds, and turned into one of the stars, and that was the last we saw of it. Palmer looked at me, and I looked at him, and he said, do you want to call that in? And I said, hell no. And he said, okay. And we never really talked about it again after that. We never told anybody about it because we didn't want the ridicule and all the other BS that was going to come down on us.
How close do you think that cylinder craft came to you and Palmer?
It was over our head, and I want to say it was probably 1,000 feet or less over our head.
Did it hover?
Yeah, you know, I remember looking straight up at it, and for a few moments, I was looking up at it, and it wasn't moving. And I remember like a yellow light, a green light, a blue light, and a red light. Some of them were more intense than the others, and I can't remember which ones were which, but it seems to me the yellow light and the blue light were a little more predominant.
These are lights you were looking at on the bottom of what was a very long cigar-shaped craft.
Correct. And when I was looking at the bottom of it, I remember I was looking at it almost like I've been knocked out a couple of times. You get kind of tunnel vision. So I just remember looking at that, and it just seemed like it was tunnel vision or cloudy around the edges. I was just very focused on that hatch and what was on the bottom of it. I remember when I first looked at it, I thought, wow, this is the size of a football field, which is 300 feet or 100 yards long. And it just seemed that it was that long of a craft.
Which is big.
Yeah.
And to be cylindrical, like a cigar that has been reported for 30, 40, 50 years, these cigars, but what are they?
I have no idea.
As it came down close over you and you guys are watching, could you hear any sound?
No, I couldn't hear any sound whatsoever. And again, I don't remember hearing anything. If Palmer was talking, I never heard him. If the birds were chirping, I never heard him. I just remember staring up at this thing in total awe.
Where were you and this cigar-shaped UFO? Where were you in relationship to the sites in Rendlesham Forest?
I was at the guard shack.
East Gate guard shack?
Correct, on Woodbridge property.
If it were 1,000 feet above you, was it directly above where you were at the guard shack?
It seemed directly above me, yes. To the point I had to crane my neck and look up.
And it moved from what direction to that point?
It was moving from the direction of the forest up the road.
Think back to listening to Coast on Thursday, August 27th, and hearing the RAF Bentwaters Deputy Base Commander, Charles Hault, describe the lights of December 28th as extraterrestrial in origin. What went through your mind?
Well, first, I was glad that he admitted publicly that there was a craft. And secondly, honestly, the next thing in my mind was, good, maybe now somebody will listen to me. So.
Were you surprised?
Oh, yeah. I was absolutely surprised because he's never even come close to admitting with that much clarity that what he saw was something extraterrestrial. I mean, it just seemed like, okay, so he's saying there was a craft. I'm saying there was a craft. All this brass came out because they thought there was a craft. There must have been a craft, you know?
Well, it seems that the value of your report is that a week and a half after a three-night event of phenomena in Rendlesham Forest that you and your colleague Palmer see a UFO, then a while later, after authorities had come out into the Rendlesham Forest, that you and Palmer back at the East Gate have a cigar-shaped, unidentified craft come down 1,000 feet over your heads.
Correct.
And what is that cylinder, cigar-shaped object in relationship to that glassy triangle that Sergeant Peniston touched on the night of December 26, 1980?
No idea. No clue whatsoever.
What would you like to see happen?
I think, honestly, that somebody probably owes a lot of people an apology for whatever kind of debriefing they got. You know, I've heard sodium pentothal to, you know, some mind tricks and stuff when they interrogate people. So, you know, somebody ought to come clean, at least let us know what they did. I was never really debriefed or talked to after the incident.
No debriefing?
No, which was really strange.
What I would like to understand is, what is the relationship between the glassy triangle on the floor of Rendlesham Forest Sergeant Jim Peniston touched on the night of December 26th, and a week and a half later, on January 9th, you two see a huge cylindrical unidentified aerial object hover over you at only 1,000 feet and at the East Gate.
Mm-hmm.
An event that you and Palmer experienced directly a week and a half after the main Rendlesham Forest event, but no one knew about this big cylindrical craft until you talked with me and a few others a couple of decades later.
Right.
The fact that all of you were exposed to something that is now described as extraterrestrial, how does that make you feel today in 2009?
About as confused as I was in January 1981. I mean, just that much more confused. I still have no clear answers. I still don't know if we were subjected to some sort of experiment, if it was mind control, if we actually saw our craft. I mean, as far as I know, I saw our craft and so did everybody else. I still think what I saw was a UFO over our heads. I just can't see any vehicle making no noise and flying the way this thing did. In this case, this was not of this earth.
And then what are the implications of all these events in the Rendlesham Forest in 1980 to January 1981, and perhaps even beyond to other related phenomena around the earth, maybe at other military installations that none of us have heard about even yet?
Yep. Here we are 30 years later. We still have no clear answers of what's going on. I mean, when you have crafts flying over nuclear weapons storage areas and nobody seems to have a grip on what they are, you'd think they'd be kind of important.
And why did the governments remain so silent?
I think just utter fear that they couldn't. What are they going to tell the people? Something's flying over our nukes and we have no control over it.
And George, in I think it was September 17th, I received an email from former RAF Bentwaters Deputy Base Commander Charles Hald after he read my Earth Files report with Airman Steve LaPlume. And he said, quote, "After the first incidents of December 26th to 28th, General Gordon Williams told me he wanted to be contacted if anything similar to what we had experienced ever occurred again. Wendell Palmer and another cop, could have been LaPlume, I just don't remember, called me at night through law enforcement and told me they saw something strange at Woodbridge. They thought it to be a UFO. I called Gordon Williams on the hotline, and we both went out independently and met at Woodbridge. I had a Triumph TR-8 at the time, and with the top down, I could fit under the flight line gates. I called the Bentwaters Tower and got clearance to cross the runway. Williams in his staff car had to drive all the way around. I arrived well before him. Unfortunately, whatever they saw was gone by the time we got there. We thanked them, Wendell Palmer and presumably Steve LaPlume, and left soon after. If LaPlume was on duty that night, C-Flight was working. He would have heard the radio chatter on the police frequency. He might also have seen something. I know he was at RAF Bentwaters during the time frame and was involved somehow, close quote, Colonel Charles Holt. So he is basically affirming everything that Steve LaPlume contacted me about.
Good job, Linda.
So when you put all of this together and you add the piece that we talked about in August, that Jim Peniston, under sodium pentothal, 3.5 hours, hypnotized in an interrogation in February of 1981, that he comes up under hypnosis that he did in 94, trying to penetrate what the military did to him back at Bentwaters, and he comes up with these phrases that what was in that black glassy triangle that looked like a piece of solid onyx in the forest, that they were time travelers from a far distant future coming back here to use current Earth life as, quote, band-aids, unquote, for survival. If any of that is true, and if our government has information about the fact that time travel is a reality, that part of the phenomena that has been sort of, I guess you would say, challenging the entire planet to understand for more than half a century, it goes back millennia, that it would relate to actual time travel technology? Is this part of the reason why the governments want to remain so silent and why Margaret Thatcher would have said to Georgina Bruni, yes, it happened, but we can't tell the people? It's troubling that authorities for so long keep coming to the same conclusion that the planet cannot know that we're not alone, that the planet can't know about time travelers, other dimensions, and possibly extraterrestrial biological entities from other solar systems, when I think it is becoming so clear that even Colonel Holt calls what happened to him in Rendlesham Forest on December 28, 1980, extraterrestrial in origin. And I'm going to try to keep moving forward.
You have to.
With as many people as I can. It helps if people listening will email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com, as Steve LaPlume has, as Richard Bertolino has, and others that I haven't introduced yet to the Coast audience, because we all need to help each other penetrate essentially government misinformation and blocks on purpose. And we need to find out what is it that they are keeping from the world public.
This is one of the better cases. I think it might be even better than Roswell.
Yes, I think it is not only better, I think it is far more significant. And if we could understand exactly what the governments are keeping hidden, we might have some answers to at least a part of the longtime UFO phenomena that I've always felt all of us deserve to know, and it may or may not have relevance to what is coming up in our own Earth future.
Linda, next hour, let's open up the phone lines again, and we'll have conversations with Linda. But again, you're still looking for some additional witnesses and information?
Yes, and my email address is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Again, it's just like my website. Think of a reporter who files news about the Earth. So it is earthfiles@earthfiles.com.
And the crash retrieval conference that you're going to is?
November 6th to 8th. It is in Las Vegas at the Tuscany Suites Hotel and Casino. And John Burroughs will be joining me on Saturday, November 7th, and we will be bringing the latest information that we have.
Let's make sure we have some guests lined up. I'll be getting ready to go to Chicago for the Radio Hall of Fame that I have to MC, but let's get a few guests maybe that Friday night if you could. We'll be back.